Are you too tired to do this?
No.
All right, here we
I feel
go.
like a million bucks.
All right.
Do I look tired?
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't sleep much last night.
Welcome to episode 41 of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck? Where we revisit great movies from the 80s and 90s that actually might suck. My name is Kalen Egan.
My name is Travis Sintel, and I'm wide awake.
Wide awake. Look at you. Bright-eyed, bushy-tailed.
Ready to go.
What time is it right now?
I'll tell you what time it is. It's the witching hour, Kalen.
So, today's episode is Halloween 3 Season of the Witch. And Travis doesn't know what this is.
No,
at all.
No.
You know Halloween.
Yes.
You know what Halloween is. Have you seen Halloween?
Yes.
I've
seen the first Halloween.
And that's the only Halloween you've ever
Correct.
Seen?
Correct.
All right. Well, what if there was one thing about the Halloween series that you feel would be accounted for in every single movie, what would that be?
Stabbing.
Okay. But like...
Michael Myers?
Right. He's not in this movie.
What?
So this movie...
Wait, isn't Halloween the story of Michael Myers killing people?
Yes.
This series.
Correct. Mm. Not this one. Mm-hmm. Here's what this movie is. Halloween 3 is the... After Halloween 2, which John Carpenter wrote but did not direct,
mm-hmm.
he thought, here's what I want to do. I want Halloween to be a serial series where every movie will come out once a Halloween or every two Halloweens or something, and they're always going to be a separate news story. Kind of like the Twilight Zone, but as a feature film, spooky, you know? Mm. And so this was that. They did a movie called Halloween 3 Season of the Witch. Has absolutely nothing to do with Halloween.
Is it the only one in the series without Michael Myers?
Hold on.
Oh.
It came out. Everyone hated it.
Great.
Hated it.
This podcast is just a fucking disaster. Can we just take a second?
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Just wait a minute.
I'm frustrated by our podcast right now.
Wait a minute, Travis.
All right,
wait a minute.
Go on.
So Halloween 4... The producer, who had produced all three Halloweens up until this point, was like, all right, fuck this, fuck this, fuck this. We're going back to Michael Myers. He's back.
Yeah.
And from then on, 4, 5, 6 million,
yeah.
It's always been Michael Myers' story. He returns. Jamie Lee Curtis even came back for Halloween H2O. However, so saying that, you would think this movie's garbage. It has had a major resurgence where people, it's not exactly that they think it's an unheralded masterpiece, but it's unfairly maligned.
Do you think it's deserved this resurgence of affection?
Yeah.
You probably haven't seen it that recently.
You know what? I've made a huge mistake. I'm gonna propose something crazy to you right now.
What?
I'm gonna propose that we stop recording.
Pick
this intro up when I can get my friend Charlie Lazarica to come on the episode, because he has been trying to write an unofficial sequel to Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
Well, obviously we should have him on. Let me just say this, though, before we cut. I'm just tired of watching bad movies, man. I want this movie to be good. I feel... Because you're right. I'm tired right now. I'm feeling vulnerable. I had a nice whiskey earlier. And I just wish that we did movies that were more entertaining to watch. We've had a run of some movies that were... They felt like a challenge. We watched fucking Jumanji, which I've gotten fights with everyone about. here's my conversation with everybody. I'm sorry, just give me a second.
Yeah,
to get
go for
my
it.
Chest. Because here's my conversation with everybody about Jumanji. Hey, we did Jumanji for the podcast. Oh, Jumanji's good. Fuck you. It's not. And then they go, yes, it is. And I go, no, when's the last time?
They say, yes, it is.
Every time. Every fucking time. And fuck you. If you're listening and this is what you've said to me, because every time they go, yes, it is. And I say, when did you see it? They go, oh, like 20 years ago. I'm like, yeah, it's not good. You're wrong. They're like, no, it's great. Here's the way they prove it. Watch, I'll text my friend. Hey, they'll text, you know, Jeannie. Hey, Jeannie, is Jumanji good? And they'll show me their phone and go, yeah, Jumanji's great. And that's the response. Mm. I'm like, that's not a fucking argument.
Mm.
It's ruining relationships. So then we got to... Listen, the last bunch of episodes have been very disappointing, I feel like, in terms of the content. We watched fucking Willow, which had good parts. We watched True Lies, which had some good parts. But overall, this is making me hate cinema, and this is not the point of our podcast. And now you tell me that Halloween 3 was fucking panned by everybody.
Yeah.
And I'm terrified to go into another bad movie, and I feel very very, very sad about the world and very vulnerable. It, part of it's the election still lingering.
I have Can I tell you something I found out about Jumanji? What? About Jumanji, the new Jumanji.
I'm interested by this.
Which is not a reboot, but a sequel that keeps the continuity of the original.
Please tell me what.
The Rock is playing the avatar in the world of Jumanji of the player. So as they play, he is somehow controlled or inspired by the gameplay. He's a fictional character in the world of the board game.
Can I say something? I fucking hate that idea. I'm not doing a thing. I'm not doing a shtick right now. Yeah. I fucking hate that idea. Because it's goddamn ridiculous. Because the board game of Jumanji doesn't have chutes and ladders and vines you swing on. It's a goddamn series of spaces that you move your piece from. There's no goal to be accomplished. There's no fucking avatar. The fucking game pieces aren't people. They're just horse heads. Yeah. Like, what the fuck are you talking about?
They're like little pieces of ivory.
Damn everything. Yeah. And now, I just needed you to start this podcast by not telling me Halloween 3 was bad. And you literally, that's all you
watched. I didn't say it was bad. I said people think it's bad.
Yeah, great.
People thought it was bad, but it's had a major reappraisal. Doesn't that mean anything to you?
No, it means it's going to suck. Does your favorite movie suck? The answer is yes. Podcast over. Now we're done. We finished our podcast.
Well, I need to bring in Charlie because he loves this movie and he really will defend it hardcore. And he will tell you that it's had a major resurgence and a reappreciation by the geek community. And I feel like you need to give this movie a shot. I mean, you're forgetting the project of this show, which is not just to celebrate movies we all know are good necessarily. It might be to take movies we think are good and say they're bad. It might also be, and it has before, take movies that people don't think are much and realizing they're masterpieces.
I expected a 50-50 ratio. It's like 90-10, and I'm feeling a little beat down by that. Can we just watch Labyrinth?
We may have stacked the bag a little bit by including this bullshit.
All the Police Academies. That was my fault. I own that.
So let's just do this. Let me take a break. Let's both take a break. We'll come back, complete this intro.
I'm going to get some sleep.
You just take it easy. Let's have another whiskey. Let's just go to bed. And then we'll wake up and I'll bring Charlie out and it's gonna be great.
I'm sorry I yelled.
Okay, we're back. We got him, guys.
It was
a struggle, but we pinned Charlie down. It was not a struggle, because as previously mentioned, Charlie loves this movie. Not true, I'm told. Not true.
I appreciate what they were trying to do. I admire the intent. And there are moments in the film I enjoy.
Yeah.
And I think I enjoy the idea of it more than the actual final product, for sure. And I think it still has potential in the future. Even.
See, what I'm trying to do is sell Travis. I'm trying to get him...
Wait, let me say this.
...slightly interested in watching this.
Two things. One, I am much better rested now than I was in the last segment. I've seen some things in the film and on television that have been subpar. That are not on our podcast,
right.
Which oddly makes me feel better.
That it wasn't just the era.
Yeah, that it's just the way cinema is. And I'm actually very excited to see a standalone horror film, which is what I now understand this to be. That seems really appealing to me, honestly, right. As opposed to like episode 9 of some bullshit.
Yeah, and Charlie, we'll do like a whole intro of you in a second. But I want to like put as a kind of parameter for the conversation, or not borders, but like the context of it is what I really want to talk. You know, this whole show is about nostalgia and kind of looking back and seeing what holds up and what doesn't. And this is the first one, maybe the thing that is really it's been reappraised, like dramatically reappraised. We're watching this on a special edition, super stuffed with extras Blu-ray release. So like, I want to talk about what that phenomenon is and why a movie like this, which is just thrown the fuck out, you know, I mean, on the trash heap when it comes out, how and why, you know, what Halloween as a series did, what Carpenter's career created, you know, that made this possible to sort of be reassessed or reevaluated. And then obviously, specifically, however much you want to talk about it, what your kind of relationship is to it and has become to it, you know, going forward into your career. So before we get to all of that.
God damn, that's a lot of stuff to talk about.
It's a lot of
intro.
We're
going to do it. We're going to do it all. And we're going to watch it. And we're going to talk about how the movie itself.
I'm tired again. Sorry. I know I was awake, but now I'm fucking exhausted.
Oh,
again.
Man. I thought that was so exciting. Oh, I thought that was so loaded and exciting. But Charles de la Zarica, which I neglected. I neglected to identify him.
You forgot the duh.
Yeah. he and I have known each other for something like 10 years, almost as long as I've known Travis, honestly. And we also write scripts together. We collaborate on stuff. Charlie is a renowned, I think it's fair to say, like a wildly renowned documentary filmmaker. Many of them on films that are in our bag, you know, sort of making ofs and evaluations of the story of behind the scenes of the movies. So anyway, it's really awesome. We've been talking about having you on here since the very beginning. So this is a funny one to do it with.
But It is. And strangely enough, as you were talking about it, I realized that Halloween 3 is the Rogue One of the Halloween movies.
Yeah,
they should call it Season of the Witch, a Halloween story at this point. Because it's the first standalone and the only standalone in the Halloween
series.
That's amazing. And for me, I guess I'll just talk about my first memories of Halloween 3 because I loved, obviously, the original was a classic. I mean, I loved Halloween. That was fantastic. And even Halloween 2, I think, is a solid film. It's kind of like the Jaws 2 to the Jaws. It's a fine sequel, you know? But then I started seeing the posters for Halloween 3 with, like, that scary witch mask face and the silhouettes of the kids on the horizon
right,
at the bottom.
Which is the flip side of this thing. So
of the Blu-ray, yeah. And that was in the summer of 82, which is still, in my opinion, the greatest movie summer of all time.
Oh, this came out in that
summer?
This
is summer of 82,
yeah. Oh, wow.
So in the same summer as E.T., yeah. Poltergeist, Star Trek II, Blade Runner, Tron, Conan the Barbarian, The Road Warrior, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Rocky III. I'm probably forgetting.
The Thing, right?
The Thing. My God, how did I forget The Thing? It was a murderer's row of great, fantastic cinema.
Yeah, you know,
and Halloween 3, puny little Halloween 3, just kind of like wobbled out in the middle of all that and got decimated.
Yeah.
You know, but what I enjoyed about it was it still had that John Carpenter feel, even though he didn't direct it. But I mean, he'd worked on the score, obviously,
yes.
and just it had that the way it was shot. I believe Dean Cundey shot it. I don't remember if he shot it or not.
He did.
Yeah. So it still had the same flavor as the first two films. But it was fascinating because it was just so not, I think, what people signed up for when they see Halloween in the title.
Well, let's talk about it. Like, what was, I mean, I alluded to it when we were talking before, but how did Carpenter position this thing? Because he was kind of front and center on it, right, in terms of promoting the film or talking about it?
Well, I think the original intent was because they felt that they had exhausted the Michael Myers story in the first two movies, that they were going to create an anthology brand. And it was basically going to be like John Carpenter presents Halloween.
Which he wanted to do even on Halloween 2, right? He just wanted, didn't he just want to move on and do something?
Possibly. I'm not 100% sure on the history on that, but that sounds reasonable. I just believe that the idea was, okay, every Halloween now, they would come out with a new anthology style, you know, series of movies.
Right.
That would be ostensibly a Halloween themed movie of some kind. It just had nothing to do with Michael Myers. It's kind of actually what like recently Tales of Halloween, that anthology movie that came out, that a lot of my friends actually were directors on. And it's interesting because I do think there was some potential in that. It's just that the problem is Michael Myers was such a brand name villain back then, and that he was not even remotely involved in this movie. I think it just turned people off. Like, they felt like they got gypped.
I gotta say, I mean, we're getting into the movie now, but when you see it, it's like, the predominant question for me is like, whose fucking idea was this? Because the idea is bonkers. Like, it's just so, there's like 90 ideas, and like an epic sort of stuffed with plot horror movie is super strange, and not at all what Halloween was. That's not what The Thing was. It's like, you know, it's a very weird animal that they wanted to tell this meandering, multifaceted story.
And it's not just the story and the plot, it's the mythology that they're really creating that, again, has nothing to do with what came before.
And which was, and like you said, not being set up to be a franchise piece. It's just like, that's it. This is going to be one movie.
And that could be probably why some of the film's problems, I think, actually kind of skated by, because they thought, okay, well, this one's fine. We'll move on to the next one next time. It'll be our Halloween 4 will be some entirely different story, and people will forget about whatever problems they had with this one.
Because, right.
I mean, there's some really big holes and weird shortcuts that they take in the story. And wait, you haven't seen it yet, right?
No.
Okay, so
but you can spoil it.
It's not
a spoiler situation.
Let's let him take the ride.
Yeah, it's not a spoiler situation. It's just like there's a lot of like irregularities in this film. It's like, I don't know why they did that that they could get away with that. And it's strangely kind of like sexist and really kind of the villain's master plan is really stupid. And it just, I mean, there's like a really lot of dumb stuff in this movie. However, there are some really great ideas in there that I think still have potential, and I really do believe that Carpenter probably had a much grander vision for this at some point that just got folded into this probably smaller budget than they wanted. Right. This kind of this universal, just kind of like, let's just get it out during the summer and get some money off the Halloween name approach.
Right.
You know, I do think there's a grander version of this in someone's imagination somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe we'll watch the features at some point to investigate that. But I mean, okay. So that all tees us up kind of perfectly for this. I mean, look, I'll tell you very quickly, my experience with Halloween 3 is I had never bothered to watch it until Charlie said, watch it. And that's part of why this sort of, you know, it's, and I don't know how much you want to go into it, but like, we've talked a lot about this movie and about some of the ideas contained within it and totally acknowledging its bizarreness, preposterousness, but in some ways, really, for me, like, learning to appreciate that. And when I watched it, I watched it with my wife, and we both had a pretty awesome time because it's totally weird. And it's like, it's fun to watch something this weird. And so that leads to this sort of topic of conversation I'm really interested in is why. I mean, why did this movie get revived or rescued?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think it's two reasons. One is because the film kind of was like the redheaded stepchild of the, not only the Halloween movies, but the movies that came out that summer.
Yeah.
I think people, there are certain types of people that love to embrace failed movies or failed anything, failed bands, failed books, whatever. It's like they like to be like the cool kids. Like, I'm part of this group that gets this weird, ugly duckling.
Yeah.
And I think Halloween 3 is one of those movies that it was just easy to adopt for those types of people. So yeah. I think that began the appreciation of some people actually do love this movie. I think also the film has evolved into actually being more relevant now than it was when it came out in terms of humanity's relationship with technology.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that this film is actually ahead of the curve in that regard, even though they probably had no idea where we'd be today. I'm sure, like, totally. Not even close. But the idea that technology and a bit of magic and witchcraft, being the secret sauce and all that, would spell the end of humanity in some way, or you know, like our you know, just like the apocalypse, which this film kind of hints at in a way. It's not a spoiler, but there's a bit of a it's over moment at the end of the film. Yeah. I think that's what makes the film resonate now more than when it came out. I think when it came out, it was just like, yeah, it's just a cheesy episode of Amazing Stories or Tales from the Dark Side or Tales from the Crypt or whatever. It was kind of just a genre piece. Now I actually think it has some relevance.
Yeah, it has. Well, and that's kind of where you and I started talking about, you know, potential references to this movie. If we were going to tell a new story that embraced a new horror thriller story that embraced some of those thematic elements, we found that there was an interesting possibility in sort of tying it to some of the craziest ideas in this movie. And I think you're right, that makes it more relevant. I have a different theory, though, and a slightly different theory, which is that, you know, one of the things we've been doing on this show is watching all these movies, some of which were, we put everything from the era in the bag. I mean, we've put fucking everything. There's like 440 movies in here, and they're just anything you've ever even kind of heard of that has remained like marginally memorable.
Police Academy 5.
Yeah, but we watched Police Academy 5 because we put all the Police Academies in there because everyone knows what Police Academy is. And so, for instance, we watched Willow the other day, and, you know, which is, I think, still nobody gives a fuck about Willow. They kind of hate it and they kind of think it's stupid. And my experience with Willow was that it's actually kind of better than you think. It's very bad and it's deeply disappointing if you put it in any George Lucas or Star Wars context, but it's kind of fun and kind of cool and there's kind of creative stuff in there. But what it doesn't really have is personality. And this movie is soaked in personality in terms of the score, in terms of the weirdness of it, and all of that stuff. I think in the era, it's very hard to identify something that is unique. It has unique attributes from its era, which will somehow play better later. I mean, it's like, I can't imagine what that would be from right now, but of course we wouldn't know, right? And so, but the music in this movie has become wildly reappreciated. I mean, it's gorgeous. It may be, honestly, it's one of Carpenter's best scores.
I totally agree. This is like probably my favorite Carpenter score. It's either this or Escape from New York, I think. But I love this score. And there's a track on there called Chariots of Pumpkins, which I just never get enough of. It's an amazing cue that I love.
Yeah. And it's a movie that, and I don't know how old you were in 82, Charlie, but when I hear about people loving this film or having memories of it, it's because they were little children. And there are weird things in this movie that when you watch it through the lens of, let's say, an 8-year-old who caught it on TV, you're like, oh, that would hook you like a motherfucker, and that would not let you go. And there's a the repetition of a song in this movie that you'll leave here with it stuck in your head. I guarantee it. Mm. And like for a kid, that's such a hook. It's such a memorable hook. And like anything that hooks into a kid's imagination will inevitably win out. Like that stays with you. It's why we still talk about Peanut Butter Solution, like these stupid movies from the 80s. But they've got a fucking thing that really gets children. And that's, I think, a lot of what we're processing here is kind of how you watch movies as a kid versus as an adult.
I just realized this has a, kind of a Temple of Doom connection in that you have two adult protagonists trying to save a bunch of kids.
Yeah, that's
true. I was just watching the video of the menus on the Blu-ray.
Well, right now. I mean, and who the adults are is baffling.
Yeah.
Like who they've decided to make the protagonist.
But I think you're absolutely right about the kids angle. I didn't think about that before. This is the perfect like R-rated horror movie for kids in a way, because I mean, yeah, there's some blood and there's some ugliness and some sex and stuff, but nothing that's really that bad. I mean, it's more of a PG-13 movie in these days.
Yeah, you know? And what the other thing I found out, or we've found out, is like we watch like Short Circuit and stuff, which, you know, is horrible, just amazingly horrible. But some of the movies that seem to stick with kids or people of our generation is intricacy of detail and plot. Like kids grab onto story and plot in a really weird way where they can tell you in detail, you know, we had my friend Matt Robison was on for Short Circuit 2. Which inexplicably he'd watched 1,000 times as a child. And he could tell me every single plot beat of Short Circuit 2. And it's like, why is this in your head? And there's a weird way that kids process storytelling at that age that I think this movie speaks very strongly to, which is like, and then this, and then this, and then this. And that sort of like is its own train of thought. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I think every kid has that. It, for us, it was Labyrinth, which is just a plot, 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 plot thing that we could all repeat. But I think it's a matter of where you grew up and what your parents exposed you to, which is Kaelin's issue.
This predates me as a kid. So, you know, the people who sort of respond to this movie, I mean, I didn't see it until I was an adult.
But there are things I think that every kid latches onto, and I think plot is one of those things for sure that sort of propulses it. You know, and it's the ones, it's either some weird hook, like Short Circuit 1 has this anthropomorphized robot, and no one can tell you the plot, even today. We've seen it recently. I challenge Kaelin just to say the plot. It's either some sort of propulsive plot thing or some really, really high concept hook that kids seem to really latch onto.
Right.
Or this movie called The Hug-A-Munch Film. Have you heard of this movie?
No.
It's a made for TV. It's a made for TV film, and that is the fear of death that kids latch on.
Trauma. That one's hook is trauma. It'll traumatize you emotionally, which a lot of these movies did.
Yeah.
All right. Well, cool. Well, I mean, let's just watch it. And so, Travis, you can sort of, with all that in mind, I think it's a nice intro to what we want to talk about afterward. So let's just do it.
Mr. Cochran will be right along.
I don't like this place. It gives me the creeps.
I have to go to the bathroom.
Mommy?
Relax a minute, will you? Mr. Cochran will be here and everything will be fine. He just wants my opinion about some television commercials or something. You know, I still can't figure out why they won't take my orders for next year.
You know how I like to work ahead, and well, they're just not interested at all.
Maybe they're not going to have Halloween next year.
Ha, ha, ha. All right, roll it.
It's time. It's time. Time for the movie.
No, this is just the same old stunt.
It's come. All you lucky kids with silver shamrock masks, gather round your TV set, put on your masks, and watch.
Honey, don't get too close. You'll ruin your eyes.
Jack-o'-lanterns, gather round and watch. Watch the magic pumpkin. Watch.
I think this whole thing is a big joke. I mean, look at this.
Are we running?
We are recording.
Recording.
Yeah.
We've been sort of lightly, affectionately criticized for failing to summarize the movies before we get into a conversation about the movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I want Travis to summarize this movie.
No, I was preparing to do that.
I good. Because you hadn't seen it before.
Oh, no, no, no. No excuse necessary.
Great. Let's do it.
Can
you do it?
Yeah, I can do it. Because I want to do it quickly. This jealous. Movie... No, I can do this. This movie is about an Irishman who, through details that don't matter, has decided that because the planets are in alignment for the first time in 3,000 years, he has to make the hills run with the blood of children.
You're jumping right
no, hold
to
on.
The...
I'm summarizing it quickly.
Poor mythology.
Yeah. And he has decided to enact this 3,000 year cycle's murder of children plan by making all the children wear masks, and they have some electronics in them that kill them. And so the whole movie is about this guy's plot to destroy the children and a doctor who finds out about it and has to go stop this dastardly deed. Done.
Oh, wow. I
any
guess
questions?
That's what happens.
Any fucking questions, you guys?
I mean, the fact is you don't find any of that out until the 80th minute of the movie.
Here's the thing, though. Because I was preparing to do the summary, I expected you to ask me to do that. Because it's nuts. I realize that if you try to do this linearly, yeah. It sounds insane.
So what, if you were, without going into plot details, if you were going to explain to people what the first 80 minutes of the movie are, how would you go about doing that? Because this guy Travis is talking about is not the main character.
Here's how I would describe it. Imagine a pretty weak Black Mirror premise, double the length of a normal Black Mirror episode, and then set it in motion. That's how I'd say it.
Jesus Christ.
Poor Stacey Nelken.
Yeah,
just
I'm just
no
saying.
Love.
She's just getting cut out completely. Yeah. All right. We're going to... I assume plot details will manifest as we continue.
Yeah, you don't need to know them. That's the thing about this episode is you don't need to know. It's just a doctor trying to get to the bottom of this mask plot. That's really it. And there's all these twists and turns.
Did you like this movie? Where are you at? What are you thinking about?
Me?
Yeah, you.
Well, I will say it's the most I've seen people on their phones in a movie of any podcast we've ever done.
Are you talking about yourself?
No. I was the least.
You were not the least.
The
because
least.
I was considering calling you out for
the
being
least.
On your
I,
phone
same to you.
So much.
Same to you, Caleb.
Well, I've seen it.
Yeah. I mean, this is the most anyone's been on their phone in terms of a room. So of any podcast
I was on my phone
we've
far
ever done.
More for Jumanji. Far more.
I don't think that's true.
I wasn't surfing on my phone.
I was looking up some of the stuff about the movie because Joe Dante was originally attached to direct this, which is
wow.
surprising to me.
But this is an auteur piece. This guy wrote and directed.
Yeah, but
film.
Apparently Joe Dante was going to do this.
He's going to direct his script?
I don't know. That's all
he
I
was just
going
to make Halloween 3.
I guess.
I could see Joe Dante doing a pretty good job
with this
movie,
yeah.
especially back then.
I think it'd be better, actually. Yeah.
I don't think it would be. Here's my controversial statement. I didn't feel like I was on my phone a lot. I felt like I was really paying attention to the movie. And I have a new theory about why this movie is being reevaluated. And I want to go on record as saying, I think I really love this movie. Mm-hmm. It is so demented and so personally deranged that this one guy, I don't know if these things scare him, but it's enough to know that he thinks them that I'm like, who the fuck is this guy? How was he allowed to make this movie and that it exists and is such a, I don't know, man, like complete portrait of a weirdo. Like it's a psychologically weird person made this movie. And he just sort of unchained himself. And I am so grateful that, like, and it really reminds me that movies like this don't come out, or if they do, they're kind of roundly mocked or dismissed. But this is a real, like, they made a real movie out of this guy's dark, bizarre brain. And I can't believe it. And I liked it a lot. And it's very boring, and it's not scary, but it is, like...
It's not weird
it's
enough.
It's fucking
though.
Just. Yes, it is.
No, it could be
yes,
so much weirder.
Is. No, it couldn't.
I would buy.
Could not, if it were weirder, it would not be weird. It would not be weirder. You know what I mean?
I know
were,
what you're saying, but I disagree.
It could not be weirder. Could not be.
It could be.
No.
I neglected to mention that all the henchmen of the Irishmen are machines and robots. Sorry. I should have mentioned that earlier.
You neglected to mention everything.
No. It's because it's not cohesively weird in one direction. It just feels like scattershot weirdness to me in a way that's sometimes pleasurable. Like I don't think this movie's terrible. I just think
it's not weird enough in a singular direction to make me think I have a sense of the filmmaker like you seem to do.
I don't have any sense. How could you know this man?
I don't know.
Nobody can know this man.
I don't know.
This is hypnotically insane.
Charlie,
I truly
believe Charlie, you that. Like this film, allegedly. That's the rumor about this.
Yeah. Here's the thing. It's not that it's a great film. I just find it to be a bit of nostalgia and a bit of a guilty pleasure and a bit of just sort of that type of film that came out in the 80s when I was a kid, where it was sort of like the rules of 80s genre filmmaking don't really apply anymore. And I feel like that you can get away with plenty of these types of movies back then. Like a Dreamscape. You know, I was thinking about another film, like it was kind of like an 80s film that sort of like that wouldn't play today. Probably you couldn't make Dreamscape the way they made it. So I kind of find the film interesting in terms of what it could have been. It's all about potential for me.
Yeah. Film, well, the first 20 minutes, I was pretty into it because of how stylized the first 20 minutes are. Like, all the shots are very strange, and the way the acting is very, very stylized. And it's confusingly stylized.
That is very generous. I mean, the filmmaking, the cinematography is terrific. I mean, Dean Cundey is shooting it like he shoots Carpenter movies, and they look fantastic. And he uses night really well.
Mm-hmm.
He uses Steadicam really well when he uses it.
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome on all those levels. The acting, it is not stylized. It's bad. Like these.
But I'm interested by that.
Me
too. I loved B movies back in the day, and this sort of bad acting can seem stylized because they're cohesively bad in the same direction. So it's not like he's doing one thing in the first 20 minutes and she's doing a different
thing. That's
true. Everyone's shitty in the same way,
which
feels stylized. And so for me, I was like, I can get behind this. This seems interesting. This seems fun.
Well, here's what.
And then it sort of doesn't even do that very long.
I think it does across the board. But what Charlie said really interested me, because what I was going to say is like my alt theory now about why this movie holds up is that it plays far better as a kind of disturbing horror experience because it's completely now removed from the context in which it came out. I wasn't alive when this movie came out, and you know, I don't have the familiarity with 1982 or the era to know what the fuck was going on, that this was okay. And now that I see it in 2016, I'm like, it feels like it's made by aliens. It feels like it's made by totally freaky people. And that is really fun for me. And as I watch it, especially as it got deep into itself, when it starts to reveal that it's like, you don't know that it's about robots for so long. He's a toy. And the other thing you didn't say is he's a billionaire toy maker who's selling horrible masks, yet they're treated as if they're like the greatest product on earth. It has a beautiful sort of interpretation of what Halloween is, which is just cheap horseshit that kids throw on.
Mm-hmm.
And it all feels so fucking weird. Like, we're looking at the DVD menu right now. This is the weirdest. Like, look
Can't
at it. It's so
DVD
weird.
The subtitle of this is Season of the Witch.
Yes.
So that's a thing. I spent a lot of time the last 20 minutes going, Season of the Witch.
Well, he does mention a witch
when he's briefly, going through in passing. Is that what it is? This is called this every 3,000 years. It's the witching season.
I didn't catch it on previous viewings, but there's a bit in there where Cochran, he's taking the tour through the
Cochran
mask.
Is the bad guy.
Yeah,
he's the bad guy.
Mm-hmm. He's the Bond villain in this film, and he's very Bondian. But basically, coming through the factory, and they're getting to like the racks of masks, and the kid wants the one pumpkin mask. He says, no, here we have the finished one that has the special processing and all that.
Yeah.
And he comes up, and isn't there a bit where Cochran actually picks up one of the little silver shamrock chips? It's not the tour, it's later. It's when Chalice is being everything's being explained to Chalice, Bond style. And he picks up some of the dust of the Stonehenge rock, and does he rub it on the chip? And is that the special processing?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
So that's
why
good,
they're carving
out.
Yeah,
so
carve out the Stonehenge rock. But here's what's frustrating about that.
Can I just say, this is amazing, because you did what was requested of us, which is to tell the plot of the movie.
Yeah.
I bet you $1 million not a single person understood what Charlie just said.
No, I don't even understand what I was fumbling the whole
Because way. The begin. Let me just fill in a few of the blanks that I'm trying to keep up. the beginning of the movie opens with a news report that a rock, one of the Stonehenge rocks, right, has been stolen.
Breaking
from
news.
Ireland.
Yeah. Breaking news.
Yeah. And what you discover in the end of the movie.
Stonehenge is also not in Ireland.
Is that this?
Which is really weird. Just for the record, everybody. Go on.
One of the things that you. So you discover that this billionaire toy maker who has a factory in Northern California, where you have to go physically pick up your order of toys and masks for
before curfew hits.
Before, yeah, before curfew 6 hits p.m. at 6 p.m.
Let's not get bogged down in the details.
No,
here.
No, but this is, it's important that people understand. So he's the one who stole the massive, and I mean like a full Stonehenge rock. He's not like a stone. Like he bought one of those big monoliths from Stonehenge, put it in his factory secretly. And what they're doing is they have developed microchips that they put on every Halloween mask they sell. And then what Charlie is indicating, which is true, is that he rubs Stonehenge dust on the microchip. Then the microchip zaps a blue bolt of magic into the head of whoever is wearing the mask or holding the chip.
Once it's given the signal.
And turns it into bugs.
Yep.
That's snakes.
Also snakes.
And
also
snakes.
Yeah.
Worms, snakes, and bugs.
Yes. Yeah.
That's what happens in the movie.
Can I tell you, the this is going to sound absurd that this is what disappointed me here.
And I can't believe you guys aren't on board with this.
So he gives his whole speech about masks, the purpose of masks in Irish culture. And by whole speech, I mean he glancingly mentions it in this sort of exposition speech. And he's talking about, so we had to go get this thing. I just kept thinking Easter Island would have been a much better choice. For like faces, I thought they would have cohesively done it because I don't know why Stonehenge was even in play here.
No,
as a magic being,
wouldn't Easter Island
have been the thing to do?
I'm telling you, man, it's as if whoever wrote and directed this movie like read a book about Irish mythology on October 30th, and he went to bed. And he just woke up and transcribed his bizarre
Stonehenge
dream.
Has nothing to do with Ireland, though, or Irish mythology.
Well, but in his head, he didn't read it very closely. He just kind of glanced through a picture book.
Yeah.
But I do believe, watching this film again, that this is sort of like there's some of the seeds of Carpenter's Prince of Darkness.
Oh, yeah.
And there's quite a bit between evil and science merging, you know?
Controversial statement. I think this is better. I like this better than Prince of Darkness.
Really?
I'm not. I know that you like Prince of Darkness.
That's a disappointed side. Yeah. Charlie just gave a disappointed side.
Just because Prince of Darkness actually kind of bores me because it's familiar Carpenter. I don't know. Like, this. I don't get this dude. And I can't emphasize enough how much I see this as like one man's vision.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, uncontentious statement. I think this is a really solid 50-minute movie. I don't know if it's an hour and 40-minute movie that's of goodness, because it's a lot of just like, cool, we're doing this for 20 minutes now. And it's not filled with enough weird ideas in each segment to make it like, oh, cool, this is now a new thing that we're doing. I think there's enough good ideas and interesting ideas to make it a good 50-minute, maybe an hour.
But you're using the word good like that matters.
Yeah,
like,
I mean good as in personally interesting, as in I
to
found
you?
It. Yeah, yeah. I mean personally like, oh cool. I mean I'm on board with that weird shit for a little bit here now.
I can't believe I'm actually honestly surprised you're not seeing it more my way, because like I really am. And I didn't necessarily
It's not as weird
you
as
to.
You think it is.
Yes, it is.
I don't know, man.
The main character of the movie is a
reprehensible character.
Like the save the cat moment is that he's a drunk.
Yeah,
like that's what's supposed to make you like him, is that he's an alcoholic doctor whose wife like kind of hates him.
One of the save the cat moments, I think, is that his wife's an asshole. And like you're supposed to feel bad for him, I guess. Yeah.
And he's just beaten
down. He's henpecked by this
shrewish
woman.
Totally confusing, because the first time you meet him, he's trying to be with his kids and he's pulled away to work. And you're like, oh man, that kind of sucks. Like it's not his fault he has to go to work. And then he calls up and his wife is yelling at him, like, you never come. You always promised the children things. And he's like, people were just murdered at my hospital. The cops are here. A fireman is here taking a coffee break. And they need me to stick around and deal with it. And you're like, God, this guy's life sucks. Like, this ex-wife of his is a real shrew. But then, not 10, 15 minutes later, he calls her again. And he has a six-pack of beer. And he's clearly just bailing on his children.
Yeah.
So I'm like, what is the message here? Are we supposed to like him or hate him? Whose side am I on with this guy? Because, like, do you want him to go on this weird road trip with Stacey Nelkin with the obvious intent to fuck her? And she looks 20 to 30 years younger than him. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you, I'm asking, what do you, are you supposed to like him?
what a weird question to ask about this film, as if someone has ever considered that question.
Oh, was it weird? That's what I'm saying, man. The whole movie is, every choice is weird.
Yeah, but that's a lame weird choice. There's like good weird choices and lame weird
choices. Think about the man who made that choice. Just like sit there and think about it.
And all the actors who agreed to it.
I think there are a lot of movies like this back then in terms of those weird choices, really? In terms of having a character like that. I mean, and this goes back to what I was mentioning before, is like, is there a decent female character in this movie at all?
God, no.
I mean, it's kind of offensive in a way.
Not even close. Like, not even close to.
Jason Elkins' character is kind of a plaything who goes along for the ride, yeah, for the most part.
He even gets the pleasure of beating to death when she becomes a robot, mm-hmm, inexplicably. Mm-hmm.
The lady in the room next door, mm-hmm, is, I mean, you know, again, every character, every female character in this film is kind of offensively bad, I find.
Mm-hmm. That's, every nurse at the hotel is trying to fuck the doctor.
Right. Well, this guy, and I mean, we have to talk about this guy a little bit. The main character, the main actor, what's his actual name?
Tom Atkins.
Tom Atkins. He's weirdly compelling to me as a presence. Like, I believe him as a guy, but the movie presents him without, he doesn't exhibit any effort to this effect. He's a fucking chick magnet. Like, every woman reacts
to
him.
It's the mustache, man. Yeah. It's the stash.
Yeah. He's a Chuck Norris sort of lookalike
guy. But he's way fatter and grosser and sadder.
He's kind of ripped up a little bit. He takes his shirt off.
He's thick.
He looks pretty good.
You liked him?
Yeah,
liked
I looked pretty good. When he took his shirt off, I was like, oh, I kind of get why women are into him.
Stacey Nelkin, if you know who this actress is, she's 4'10". I mean, she's tiny.
Yeah.
She's ridiculously small. And Tom Atkins is... He's not like a giant, but he's a big man. And so there's a shot. He's a
Hazard, good old boy looking.
There's this incredible shot overhead where Stacey Nelkin's wearing these like sexy lingerie.
Which she's brought on this trip.
And then like for some reason. And it's like this shot, I'm being literal, reminded me of the opening of Star Wars.
Yeah, that's good.
Where he slowly emerges into frame. This massive fleshy Hulk coming over Stacey Nelkin. And you're supposed to be into it?
Yeah, like, you are. Oh, this is
because it's the
scene.
Director's bizarre fantasy fulfillment. Yeah. I fucking love this guy. I can't get enough of this guy's choices.
Where do you want to sleep, Dr. Chalice?
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's funny to think about this whole movie as his wish fulfillment. If that scene is, imagine if every scene is.
It's his fucking fever dream. It's it's wish fulfillment, and it's what he's afraid of. It's what he's thinking about. He's worried about robots.
Yo,
he's
sure.
Obviously semi terrified of children. Maybe hates children.
Yeah, it's also funny that this robot was sent to kill the guy in the hospital, and instead of just killing him, he decided to poke his eyes out.
They have incredible. These robots who are just slaves have bizarrely elaborate ways of killing
people.
There's
a drill through the head bit, unnecessary. He pulls one guy's head off, unnecessarily.
Yeah, they pull a guy's head off, they stab a guy.
Why wouldn't that first robot go back to Silver Shamrock? Why would it like burn itself there in the parking lot, leaving evidence behind that they do kind of like barely follow through the movie?
Charlie, that's a good question.
That makes no sense.
No, you're right. Zero
sense. Nothing makes any sense. Nothing makes sense.
But not in a way that and delighted me or engaged me the way it engaged you, I feel like. Is that the guy? That's not the guy, the creepy looking guy from all these movies. Oh, God, I wish I could come up with his name. Ignore me. The guy who burns himself, is he an actor that's of some note now?
Robot guy?
Yeah, the guy who burns himself in the parking lot. Okay. Yeah. He looks like the guy who's the bad guy in Game of Thrones and a bunch of other shit.
Oh.
Anyway, it doesn't matter.
This was 34 years ago.
Yeah, he's much older now. Yeah. It looks like a young version of him.
Charlie, can you tell me more about what you mean when you say a lot of movies like this? Like, you don't need to necessarily reference other films, but like what... Because you were there. I mean, this summer was interesting. And I have seen all the movies you mentioned that are from this era, from this moment, but... Somehow this one is so much more locked into that year, even without me knowing what that means. Mm-hmm. But, like, can you maybe unpack that a little bit?
I mean, I just remember growing up, there were the classics that we know and love today. But there was, like, this whole level of B movie, which I would even say is more of a C or D level movie, that characters weren't challenged, plots weren't really thought through very carefully, huge leaps in logic. And just a little bit of like magic or horror or, you know, just genre elements thrown in to what is a pretty mediocre story with mediocre characters that somehow got sold and people would go see them because there was the X factor of, is it Stonehenge magic robots, you know, or is it something else? And I kind of feel like in that in that regard, there were a lot of these types of movies back then that just are kind of forgotten about. And the reason I think Halloween 3 sticks around is because it's the franchise it's a part of. Right. But plus, I mean, you know, everything you've said so far, I've loved hearing because I love that you enjoy the film on this whole other level that I don't think a lot of people do.
Yeah.
But it's certainly there. I mean, it's probably the most refreshing enjoyment of Halloween 3 I've ever heard. You know,
it's pure delight. Jamie Lee Curtis is in this movie, by the way.
Oh yeah, that's its connection to the series is that Halloween the movie is on TV, and it's sort of part of. I mean,
she's the voice of the announcer. The when he calls the police and she's like disconnected. That's Jamie Lee Curtis.
Oh, funny! Did you just look that up?
No, I was looking at IMDb to see who else. I didn't recognize her voice. No.
Yeah, well, that's
two movies in a row of Jamie Lee Curtis. There's something.
Oh, that's true. That's fun. This one's better.
That's probably true.
Better
actually,
than True Lies.
That's probably true.
So if we're sort of continuing on this sort of greater question about how this movie has survived, it's obviously that it's stuck in the middle of a franchise that people value on some level, mm-hmm. that is sort of carried over. And so it kind of gets dragged up. And so are you sort of suggesting, Charlie, that this movie, just by nature of kind of what it is and how it was made and who made it, that it's, we're just, that's the one that sticks out? Like, is it possible that I would have this reaction to any number of movies from 82 that nobody talks about or even references anymore?
I think so. I mean, I think if you were to go back, just, I would just say 80s in general. It was definitely the first half of the 80s. I feel like there were a lot of these types of movies that, by the way, 85 and 86 is when Spielberg's Amazing Stories went on TV.
Right.
And that is exactly like this type of filmmaking, where it's like there's one kind of like fantastical twist or hook in what's basically a pretty generic story that you tune in to see, oh, what's the twist this time?
But are there other movies from that time that are as packed with insanity as this movie? Because, I mean, this thing has, I mean, you say, yes, what you identify as the hook, sure, but there's 900 things happening that are ideas which don't go anywhere and don't tie together, but it's endlessly, I mean... This word just inevitably sounds positive, and I don't mean it that way, but it's inventive.
Yeah.
It's continuously inventive.
Well, I think people were doing a lot more drugs back then, too, frankly. Uh-huh. I mean, I really do. Yeah. I think there was a lot more freedom to just do whatever and freeform it, and let's just make shit up.
Yeah.
Whereas nowadays, I feel like that's been reined in heavily by corporate filmmaking, you know? I mean, this is a product of corporate filmmaking, but that was a different time. That's when studio heads were more filmmaker friendly. They'd say, go run off and make your movie.
I think a lot about, you know, people love to mention the sort of William Goldman quote about like nobody knows anything, and like I get what he means, but it feels like people keep redefining what he meant by that as like the eras roll on. And when I watch a movie like this, I'm like, it feels more like what he meant is like, people would roll the dice on fucking anything. And just because they're like, I don't know, maybe this guy knows what he's talking about. And he says he does. You know, he says this is going to be a great movie or whatever. And like that I am so enamored with that spirit. And I think the greatest sort of seed of my affection for this movie is that sense of like, they let this guy make this movie.
That's the part that confuses the heck out of me, because it's a series that's been established that's a successful series at this point. And they probably had a lot of options that could have gone in, a lot of directions that could have gone in, a lot of people who would have made this, Joe Dante or whoever, that could have been a different take. It's a huge opportunity for standalone horror films once a year. And then they do this thing, which is so weird to me. Like, well, it's so perplexing.
And this is, I mean, unless I'm wrong, this is, I would imagine this movie only exists because they were like, Carpenter wants to make it. Right? I mean, like, that's who they're trusting on this movie?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, he was, you know, pretty red hot at the time. Yeah. I think he kind of got his way on, within a certain budgetary restriction, I think he kind of got a lot of freedom, you know, because he had such a good evolving track record. Although this summer of 82 was bad for him.
Yes.
Because between this and the Thing bombing.
Yes.
He was a little off his game, I guess, in terms of, like, Hollywood perception.
Totally.
But
totally.
I think creatively, he was on fire, you know.
Well, that's what's period. And that's the other thing that's unbelievable about this. I mean, we watched The Thing not four or five movies ago, and to imagine them coming out at the same time, like, I understand it on some level, which is, okay, all his creative effort went to The Thing, and he poured himself into that movie.
Right.
This movie got left in the dust a little bit. But it's hard to even believe that the same guy had a hand in both, because this one's just so uncalculated and out of control and crazy. And even like if he even just bothered to read the script, he would know that.
Yeah.
So did he care? Like,
what kind I think he loved it. I mean, and again, if you look at Prince of Darkness, like, I think a lot of that stuff that was they kind of sketched it out with this, he paid off then with Prince of Darkness.
Right.
But you're talking about like, you know, this sort of crazy wild man, how did this film get made sensibility. 2 years later, Buckaroo Banzai comes out. What was that? Like what dimension literally did that come from?
Totally,
like that, you know.
Totally. Yeah, God, I mean, you're right. That's a movie that both is as, if not 50 times crazier than this, but also adds talent and cohesion to the mix.
I think there's talent cohesion here. I mean, as you pointed out, some. I mean, you know, Dean Cundey's cinematography is fantastic. And, yes.
I don't want to like revise what I was presenting earlier. I don't love this movie because it's like a fun, bad watch. I love it because it's so different and weird. And I think that different and weirdness to me is totally unique. Now, I'm very excited at the idea that there might be other things like that. Maybe ultimately that would dilute it. If I could get my head around 82, I might be like less interested in this in some way. But as an artifact from that time, I'm like so into it and I'm so baffled by it. And I feel like watching it, it's just like American movies have definitely lost something, especially genre movies.
I just think there was more faith in the filmmakers back then than there is now. And yeah. I'm probably totally wrong on this, but I feel like scripts get noted to death these days to the point that they don't even get made anymore. So you just get notes after notes from people who don't actually love movies. Whereas back then, I have to believe, just based on the product that came out, there was a bit more support for the filmmaker. There might have been notes. There might have been, you know, problem producers who tried to screw the creative vision over somehow. I mean, we saw it with Blade Runner, right?
Yeah.
I still believe that back then there was more of a sense of let's put on a show and let's kind of just figure out something cool that people haven't seen before. And by the way, there was a lot. I mean, people are so saturated now with a million different types of stories that back then it was still sort of semi-fresh.
That's true. You know? Yeah, I guess that's true that you just didn't like watching this now. It's very easy to be like, well, who thought that would work? But it's cool to think of a time where people didn't know if it would work or not.
I do like that trying thing. And I was in the first 20 minutes pretty into everything about it. The opening sequence, I really like. The title sequence?
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Oh, it's incredible.
It's really smart and really, really cool. And it was one of the few times on our podcast. There's a year at which they started putting credits at the end of the film instead of the beginning of the film. They got rid of this sort of opening montage-y stuff. But this is one of the few times I haven't been bored by it. I was into every frame of that. I thought it was really, really cool.
It's super awesome. For those listening, it's a TV. It's a close up of a old tube TV screen, and you watch the kind of lines of resolution fill in set to Carpenter's really great,
really cool song
score, synthesizer score. As the lines fill in, and it sort of beats to the music kind of goes with the image, and then the lines sort of slowly resolve into a pumpkin head.
It's great.
It's really awesome. It's really, really, really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I know what you like about films like this. We've done enough of these movies that I know that you like sort of the unbridled joy of filmmaking that's unconstrained by the necessity of like linear storytelling and all that stuff. And I don't mind that. And there's movies we've done that I think are brimming with ideas that are really cool that I find intriguing, even if I think the story falls apart. We've done movies like that, but this one, it's cool. Like I don't regret watching it.
Yeah,
but I feel like I just wish there was more stuff that interested me personally.
Right. The other thing it reminds me of, and maybe I'm just unique in this regard, is like Charlie, is this. I'm looking for approval, but
Charlie loves this movie.
Is it kind of like
we've established that this is Charlie's favorite?
It's the best film ever.
But is it like it reminded me of like bad you know drunk era George Romero when he was doing like Monkey Shines and like weird shit like that?
No, I wouldn't.
Okay,
equate to but I do like actually the comparison of Black Mirror. I do believe this is like an 80s
for sure
Black Mirror episode. Right. You know,
yeah. I mean, that's honestly why the intro interested me so much is that it ties horror to technology in a perfectly cool way.
Right,
just instantly you're like, oh cool, I know what we're doing here. There's a technology horror intro into it, and then for the next hour you're like, what the fuck is going on? Where was that intro? What are we doing?
I mean, Black Mirror would never touch the witchcraft part of it.
Right. Oh, it would be, yeah, they just
but the chips, the chips would be there, you know.
No, this, I wasn't even being facetious. This is a great 40-minute Black Mirror episode, I think. That, not great, but you could make something cool out of it, I think.
Right.
Because the core idea is interesting. This guy wants to kill kids. Halloween's a sticky way to do it. It's a little side glance to corporate culture and consumerism. You know, it's all that shit's tied in.
Well, by the way, that's another thing that I was interested in with this movie, is its version of corporate is so personal. It's like a time when, you know, and when we talk about another movie that's kind of in this vein or has some reference to this, we talk about mass corporation. We're talking about Apple, yeah, we're talking point, about actually. Google. But this movie is so strange because its version of corrupt corporate greed is one guy.
Just one
homespun dude who built this company from the ground up. Presumably, and this is a question I have just about the movie, did he start making toys because his ultimate plan was to become so rich and successful that he could kill children?
I don't think so.
I think it was... Sorry, go
on. No, I was going to say, I just think that was like his original... That's what got him his fame and fortune. And then, you know, somewhere along the way, you know, he came up with his plan. Which, by the way, his motivation and plan, and this is so super weak, it's like, why are you doing this again exactly?
Did you remember it? Because you referenced that in the intro. Did you remember the actual plot and like the motivation of all the characters and stuff?
I mean, barely, but I mean, to me, it was just, there were so many like little like, boy, you wouldn't believe how we got the stone from Stonehenge here. And then he walks away.
But yeah,
never explains it.
Yeah, he never explains it. It was really hard to get the stone here. Anyway, we did it. So
quite a thing, and then walks away.
And now I know that I'm sounding fucking ridiculous, but like that kind of shoddiness, like where it's shoddy, I'm fascinated by it, and I love it. That was fascinating. By the way, I just want to, the only note I took during the movie was there's a... when they're talking about his like legacy and like what made him famous, they talk about how he's the prank king, and that he sort of made what you would think of as like, okay, he made like hand buzzers, or he made like
I'm glad you're bringing this up. Yeah,
whatever. And so the three things that he's famous for, which they reference in the movie, sticky toilet paper.
Yeah,
I get it. That's a prank.
That's funny.
Now here are the other two. The dead dwarf gag.
Uh-huh.
How do you sell that, and what the fuck is it?
That was one of my favorite lines of the movie.
The idea that was famous blows my mind. Yeah. And then the soft chainsaw.
That one's just more traditional jokey, I think.
But it's so elaborate.
It's so silly. But like,
I know it's jokey, but it's also so goddamn weird. And just to come in a list of three things right after the dead dwarf gag, I just can't wrap my head around it. I really can't. And like those details... are unique. They're just exclusive to this guy's vision for his movie.
Is the dead dwarf gag like the equivalent of the cucumber next to a cat?
You
just put the dead dwarf and then you walk away, and then someone turns around and go, oh my God.
Terrifying.
I can't tell you how much I thought about it. Is like, does he sell a dead dwarf dummy that you then lie around the house? And the intent to be that somebody thinks like,
oh shit, it's a dead dwarf.
A dwarf came in, died in my home. I can't believe it. I cannot believe that's in the movie.
That's the kind of weirdness I could have done with more of. That's my kind of weirdness right there. Yeah. I was like, hey, more dead dwarf gags. That'd be fun. I love also that in the DVD extra, the sort of the menus, there's this thing at the end, the way that our guy gets the comeuppance is that he gets stuck, the main Irish bad guy, Bond villain, gets stuck between this computer bank where a lot of discs have been dropped, presumably discs that have been dusted with Stonehenge dust. It gets trapped between the monolith and this disc. And the disc somehow on their own, I guess, the computers make a circle of energy and then forms up with the Stonehenge monolith, and he's caught between them, and he turns in a younger man and then disappears.
Oh, younger man? I thought he sort of turned to stone.
He like turned to stone, like a white hot stone.
It looked like a younger
with a smile.
Yeah,
and then he went off into the great beyond.
But then you're right. Yeah, he vanishes. Yeah, yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's
so amazing. We neglected to mention that also.
Yeah.
I mean, I
why did that happen?
No, nothing makes sense. Yeah. And by the way, the movie ends on this apocalypse. What Charlie said earlier, it ends on this apocalyptic note where the guy, the doctor, you know, is desperately trying to call some circuit board.
FCC, or, probably.
I mean, he calls some one-all-encompassing service that somehow controls all the TV stations.
And he's trying to get them to just turn off the commercial as if that was a switch that you can flip.
Yeah. But,
and so, you know, the movie ends with him not successfully turn. It's on three main channels, the three network channels. and he manages to turn it, get them to turn off two, but for some reason they can't turn off the third, and so presumably the message goes out and lots of children's heads turn to bugs and snakes.
Yeah. Is there a tie between snakes and Ireland? Right?
Well, yeah.
So that must be it, right?
That's Saint Patrick.
Yeah. So is that a thing, or is that just a happenstance?
I think this is the same. This is the same book he was reading about Irish history and mythology, where he got it all confused.
Because the snakes, also the snakes bite.
They're also rattlesnakes. It doesn't even like make like the wrong snakes.
Also, for sure. Crickets came out of the boy's head.
There's Jerusalem crickets, right?
The big.
Those things are. I think aren't they indigenous to us, basically the U.S.
And yeah, I mean
crickets though aren't necessarily as terrifying as I mean, it's a great shot. It's gross as fuck.
See, that's the part where I realized how into the movie I was. And it was like, the movie for me, in its all its weirdness and detours and like old man lumpy sex, like it earned completely
how weird
I felt in that moment. He's pretty lumpy.
He looks great. I'm being serious, though. You're really hammering this guy.
He's clearly lumpy.
He's a big hunk of man.
Thank you, Charlie.
He's a lump of man.
No, he's a hunk, not a chunk.
So in that scene where they lock this family in a fake living room, and then the kid's head turns to grasshopper or a locust, snakes and worms, I was like, it's not scary, but I was sickened by the fact that someone had the idea, and I loved it.
There's a moment, the moment for me where I was like, huh, was the next door neighbor in the hotel is this woman who's just a, you know, tropey thing. And she is playing with her little mask and one of the discs falls off and she has a disc. And something goes wrong and it shoots her in the face, a little misfire, and this blue spark comes out. Up to this point, we've seen none of this in the film. It's just pretty straightforward. They're going to examine what happened to this girl's dad. The girl's dad passes away, and she fucks the doctor a couple days later. That's just what happens. So next door, she gets shot. This woman gets shot in the face with a blue beam of light, and then there's this grotesque thing. It's pretty incredible. Her face is all fucked up, and all her lips are peeled back, and you see her gaping mouth, and the teeth are broken, and this bug crawls out of her mouth, and it's awesome.
It's very upsetting.
It's very upsetting. It's so gross and so effective because it comes out of nowhere. 50 minutes into the movie, and I remember thinking, "Oh, we're in a whole new world."
That interested me. Well, and that's part of it. Is like it's the feeling of a movie that you don't know what is going on, and you don't know what is happening both inside the movie, and I don't know why this is so powerful for me, but inside the head of the person making it, like that suddenly became the story. Is like, how the hell do you make the connections of logic that this guy is making? It feels like a movie made by a demented person. And I think that probably, realistically, he just wasn't that talented and he was probably drunk or on drugs. And
looking for some ideas to fill time.
But the effect of it for me is like, oh no, an insane person made a movie. And like, I really felt that effectively, especially as it kept going. Whereas like, no, like nobody's stopping them. Like no one's stopping them.
I have a feature I want to introduce to our podcast that we should consider. And at the end of every episode, we should ask this question of each other. And this question applies to the entire world. Is this anyone's favorite movie? And we should ask that question seriously.
Yes, it's Kaylin Egan's favorite movie.
Okay, there it is. There it is.
No, it's a good point.
It could be. I mean, listen, I'm not saying it's not. But, you know, there's one guy maybe somewhere in the middle of America who's like, Halloween 3 is my favorite movie. Whether it's because of what Charlie said, like, it's a cool thing to, if this is your favorite movie, that makes you idiosyncratic and cool, maybe. But we should ask if anyone ever says, at the end of every episode, yes or no, is this anyone in the world's favorite movie?
Well, Charlie, what do you think?
No.
Yeah, I'm leaning toward no.
Just blunt, no commentary.
No, I'm leaning toward no, too. But
I imagine there's people who have great, genuine affection for this film.
Yeah.
Sincerely.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I guess it's possible, but I seriously don't see how this could be anyone's favorite movie.
Because it's true. I mean, unless you were the man who made this movie, maybe it's his favorite movie. But no, I mean, look, not to relitigate something we've talked about many times on the podcast, but the title is misleading.
I know. Well, no, but I think it's an interesting question because it will make us consider from the world's perspective, could this be? Is it plausible that conceivably this could be someone's favorite movie? Because most of the movies we've done, with a few quite notable exceptions. But it could be someone's
You know what
movie.
Someone could very well say, though, is like, my favorite horror series is the Halloween movies. Like, surely, or my favorite movies are the Halloween movies.
Sure. Yeah, certainly. That feels
and
right.
So this, that, and I'm not justifying why we watch this film, but like, I think that this would then fall into the category of like, why they love the series, you know, why it's their favorite horror series. This is a part of that. And so I think it's really worth looking at. I think it's fascinating that we watched this first. I mean, we have every, except for the first, every Halloween movie in the bag, because that came out in 1980. You know, Halloween 2, I think, is 80 or 81. And so if we ever pull another Halloween movie, it will be Michael Myers. But here, this is like, what a funny way to begin that exploration.
It's a nice standalone horror film. It's pretty nutty.
Yeah. So anyway, I loved it, you guys. And if, you know, again, if you want to just see something fucking weird and like kind of mess with your head, check it out.
I bet this would be really great with an audience, actually, like a midnight show.
I think you're totally
because
right.
Because
especially if they'd seen it before.
And there's a lot of laughs to be had, like intentional and unintentional laughs. And I think people would get a charge out of seeing this with like a big crowd.
I totally agree.
I think it's better if you know it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, it's a weird first look. But if you know it better, like Rocky Horror gets better every time I see it.
Well, can I ask you this before Charlie's going to pull from the bag? Would you watch this movie again, Travis?
With an audience, I would. I would honestly, if this was playing in the theater, like on a midnight screening, and you told me, hey, this is sold out except for two seats, do you want to go? I would go with you.
Okay, all right, cool.
Or I should say three seats. Charlie, you're invited.
Yeah, we got to do that sometime.
All right, these are mixed up.
All right, Charlie, thank you so much. By the way, before you pull it, we sort of, like, do you want people to follow you on Twitter or anything like that?
Plug some stuff.
Sure, I'm at, my last name is very confusing and hard to spell, but it's at LAUZIRIKA at Lazarica on Twitter. Charles Lazarica on Facebook.
Yeah.
At Lazarica on Instagram.
You should watch his first feature film that he wrote and directed called Crave, which is on Netflix right now, I think.
Yeah, it's kind of out there in the wilderness.
Charlie and I are writing a couple of different things together, which we hope to, you know, get going pretty soon.
I mean, we didn't even really talk about our possible take on
this. I know. Well, I don't know if you want to.
Let's second here. Let's just do that.
As much as you're comfortable with, you should sort of talk about what we're talking about.
Well, okay. So, what, about a year ago or so we started talking about this? Like, I just had this idea. It'd be kind of interesting to do a pseudo-sequel to Halloween 3. Not a direct, like, you know, like the next day after sequel, but like, what if there was a story that was taking place now or in near future, again, very Black Mirror-y, and that somehow there was a clue or a little story loop or a character that went back to the events at Silver Shamrock in 1982. And so Kayla and I were bouncing around ideas, and it just kind of formed into, I think, a really cool kind of techno thriller that has two scenes that take place in the world of Silver Shamrock, and the rest of it is all its own thing.
Yes.
But those two scenes are great. I love the going back to the Halloween 3 of it all. And it takes what I think they were trying to do and brings it to today, where I think it's far more meaningful, and which why I think Black Mirror is such a fantastic show, is that it comments on the human condition through our fusion now, I think, with technology. It's like it's like pre-singularity fiction that I'm really intrigued by.
Yeah, you know? And one thing Charlie sort of said that really sold me on it, especially after I saw this movie, was, you know, what suddenly feels potentially scary again is this concept of, like, black science or black magic within that sort of is the fabric of the world, which science is sort of clouding over. And it's just a fantasy horror idea, but I'm spooked out by it. I think it's an interesting, cool thing, is that the further you go as you develop technologically, the more you are kind of missing whatever may be lying underneath that you don't quite understand. And I loved that idea. And now the tying it to Stonehenge, you know, you get into fucking hot water because it gets absurd very, very quickly. But I like the marriage of mystic and scientific and technological, and I think that there's something interesting there. So that's sort of the jumping off point, I guess, right?
Yeah, totally. And I also think it'll be fun. Again, it could be its own thing, but the couple references, and they're important references. They're not just throwaway references. They're serious references to Halloween 3. I think fans of this film and the genre in general, I think, would really enjoy, like, they'd be looking at us like, who are these crazy guys? These maniacs.
That, like, well, that's, you know, the thing. And that's what I was thinking about, is like, if I could generate an ounce of this feeling for another audience member, is like, what the fuck are you talking? Like, are they thinking? The only other thing else, the last thing I'll say about that, and then Charlie, you should pull our next film, is Tom Atkins. You should clear your schedule because we're going to need you.
Yeah. Can I just say something? It's cleared.
Yeah. No. He does the convention circuit quite a bit, but I mean, we have a great Tom Atkins scene, and I really want to. I hope we can get him to do it if we make this movie because it'd be great.
It'd be so awesome.
Well, when your kid goes back and listens to this podcast, Caitlin, in 30 years, this will be the gestation of the idea that made you.
They're
going to
be like, I can't believe they're talking about it.
He did it. He fucking did it. They're talking about the thing that made him. All right, Charlie.
All right, so Charlie's picking our next movie. Thank you for joining us, Charlie. Sure. We'll have you again for sure.
Yeah, that was awesome, man. Thank you, buddy.
But what are we going to do next time on Does Your Favorite Movie Suck?
This was the 80s? Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
No, it's the 90s. We're doing 80s and 90s. I'm so psyched about that.
That's really good. Oh, that's really good. I needed this one.
This is great.
I needed this. It's a big tone shift, which I needed.
It's a big tone shift, and I have a lot to say about my child. See, this is my era. Yeah. That's why we're doing them both, is we're doing the kind of 80s nostalgia, and we're doing my nostalgia.
Got it.
So anyway, we'll talk about that next time. Thank you very, very much for listening. Bye.
Today, does your favorite movie suck?